This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
In Malaysia, university enrollment rates are increasingly higher. In 2016, almost 40% of those eligible to enroll in universities do enroll in universities. This number was actually a far cry just about 40 years ago. In 1979, only 4% of total Malaysians available to apply for universities actually enroll in universities. Because of this importance in the role of tertiary institutions in Malaysia, the government has set up a special ministry called the Ministry of Higher Education to look into this. In the studio with me this morning is Dato' Sri Idris Jusso. He is the Minister of Higher Education, and he is here to tell us how the ministry has been doing, particularly when it was just shy of 2 days to 2 years ago that you were here, Dato'. First of all, thank you for your commitment in coming back and defending your track record as the Minister of Higher Education. If you have any questions for Dato' Sri Idris, you can text us at 016-201-9000 or you can tweet us at BFM Radio. Dato' Sri, let me start off with Selamat Raya. And let's start with the notion of universities getting lesser funds in Malaysia right now. Based on the budget presentation, as well as the supplementary budget presentation by the Prime Minister, the Higher Education Ministry is getting less funding this year than it had last year. And this trend will continue on, considering the government is getting less in terms of revenue. Do you think that the diminishing budget allocation from the government is going to pose a problem for the Higher Education Ministry?
You have to look at our blueprint. So whatever we do at the moment in the ministry is based on a blueprint. Blueprint is based on our consultation, the memorandum that we read, the open halls that we have with people, focus group, and our consultation, UNESCO, World Bank, and it's a global matter. It's not just an issue. So when we look at our financial sustainability of our universities, we are 80% to 90% dependent on the government, which is not sustainable.
Okay. But this budget has been trimmed by 2.4 billion ringgit. Mm-hmm. Some of the universities, in fact, 19 out of 20 universities will face cuts as much as 20%. So while we understand that we can't be over-reliant on the government, and we never should be over-reliant on the government, can these universities cope with these cuts? Do they have lead time to actually find other sources of revenue?
As I said, it's based on the blueprint. Blueprint has been agreed upon. They understand why it's being done, and from what I see, of course, there's going to be some pain here and there, but this is a pain that we have to go through to ensure that the universities are going to be financially sustainable in the long run. And I was quoting to you, I was telling that our neighbor, Thammasat, is only 30% dependent on the government. We're not saying that it's got to be 30%, but we are saying that we cannot be 80 to 90% dependent on the government.
So you're speaking about the pains that, you know, these little bits and pieces of pain that people have to go through. Actually, it's quite serious, because I'm quoting the Sun Daily News here that over 150 contract professors between the ages of 61 to 70, they claim, the word they use is the termination of contracts of professors because of the budget's tax cut. Do you think that these professors being terminated is a direct repercussion of the budget allocation being cut to the ministry?
You have to understand, it's not termination, okay? Those professors are above 60 years old. So their contract expires when they're 60. So those who are needed by universities are going to be continued on contract basis. So it's not termination, it's not being continued because they have completed their contract. And again, I said, the Senate the Dean, the Senate of University will look into those whom they think are required to universities, and we'll continue giving them contract to serve universities.
Some of these professors, even though they are quite senior or in age, some of them are heavily specialized in their training, particularly professors in the medical field, where you're going to see those doctors that have specialized in that particular field of medicine for over 40 years. Isn't it a shame to let them go because of bureaucratic processes?
No, I won't say it's bureaucratic. But I say, again, we give money to give fund to the universities. And I said the dean of that particular faculty or the senate of that particular university will choose whom they think still fit to teach and they need as a contract professor in the universities. But I do make I throw a challenge before. If you think there is any particular, as what you said, we don't want to put it to shame. We want to make sure that anybody who's still required or needed in that particular area need to be. I ask them, give me names. Now I can look into. I can talk to them. But also, I said, it's a prerogative of university, but I can still talk to them. If you think there are names that need to be looked at, that we don't want them to be redundant, we don't want to be out of the service.
Dato, it goes without saying that when you fund something or someone, you practically hold that person in your account. Right now, the government is not funding universities as much as they did before.
Yeah.
Is this a loss of autonomy from the government or are you seeing this as giving more autonomy to the universities?
This is giving more autonomy to universities, you know, in the sense that if you're too dependent on the government, they cannot be autonomous to the government. Your autonomy only when you can, as I said, in foreign universities, they are only 40% or 50% dependent on the government and they can have more autonomy. Autonomy means that if you generate fund on your own, you can spend the money in any way you like. If the money comes from the government, there's some restrictions on some the way how you conduct yourself, you know. So by collecting more money on your own, you can be more autonomous. You can do more things as you feel right to do.
There's a tweet by Wan Saiful from Ideas. Yeah. He's asking, what are the ministry's plans to give universities more autonomy? Can I add on to that question?
Okay.
Particularly on their fate in determining research papers, do you think universities should have a more a direct say on what research they can do and cannot do, as opposed to today where the government practically dictates what can or cannot be done in terms of research?
We don't dictate what needs to be done. There's a group that looked at which are the professors. I don't even go through what research they are doing. But this group of professors, we looked into what are research you're going to do, and they probably have to defend what they're going to do and probably look into the relevance of the research that they're doing. And we do have this FRGS research fund for them. I don't even know who gets and who's not getting it, you know. So these are the group which belongs to the professors among themselves who decide what should be done, what should not be done.
Still on the funding aspect of universities, do you think that the universities today in Malaysia, both private and public, have the capacity and means and most importantly competency to source for more funds out there? Do you think that it's right for universities to treat its business, to treat its activity as a business?
Now, we're not saying that universities should treat themselves as a business. I'm against a total marketization or financialization of universities because they should be coming up with the aim of the graduates that we want to deliver, a holistic, entrepreneurial, and balanced graduate. It's not just GE, it's not just how much money you make, you know. And that's why the government's still funding. We're still funding. And if you look at UM, if you look at UTM, and even UPM, some of them are at the mark of being able to finance 70-30% on their own of the expenses. So we are giving them a target of around 70% for the time being. They are nearly there. We are 70% funding by the government. Some of them are nearly there.
Dato' Sri, do you think that Wakaf has a place in terms of finding for funds for universities?
Of course, if you look at Harvard, if you look at Oxford, they're mainly, they survive on endowment. If you look at big universities overseas, mainly based on endowment. In Malaysia, we call it Wakaf, which is Islamic-based kind of endowment. There's a big potential for it. This is what we are encouraging. In fact, today I'm launching the playbook for Wakaf in our universities.
And what does that playbook entail?
Playbook give you guideline. How should be established, what need to be done, what not, what you shouldn't be doing. It gives you a guideline how you should come up with a WACA funding.
And this is to be launched today?
It will be launched today.
Right.
Afterwards at 10 o'clock.
Okay. Right after the grill. I'm speaking to Dato' Sri Idris Jusor, the Minister of Higher Education. Up next, we'll be asking about PTPTN and also the foreign university students. This is BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, this is the Breakfast Grill. I have with me Dato' Sri Idris Jusor, the Minister of Higher Education, here to re-examine his commitment on delivering his promises made to us on BFM 2 years ago on the Breakfast Grill. Dato', do you really believe Malaysia has world-class education? This is coming from a text from a listener and also from my heart right now. Do you think that we really have world-class education?
You say, we are saying, what we're saying is that we are soaring upwards. We are improving all the time. That's why I make the commitment to come back again after the last 2 years of being here to say that my commitment. I stayed in that grill saying that Malaysia should get the best education that it should get in Malaysia.
Right.
But of course, when I say that, I can prove it by looking at our ranking, NQS ranking. If you look at it.
All right. So right now, what I have in my hand right now is a booklet by your ministry, entitled "Addressing Future Challenges in Higher Education." It says here that some of the local universities are outranking international universities. And this is by our QS ranking.
Yeah.
First of all, for those that don't know this ranking, what is it? What is the qualification of this ranking?
Say the most popular ranking in the world for universities is QS ranking. Of course, we have THE, we have ARWU, of course. Well, are we going to the most popular ranking? If you look at UM, 3 years ago, it was 167 in the world. It has gone up to 151, and it's gone up to even 146. UM has broken 150 barrier. So is USM, used to be 355 to 309 to 289. And UPM from 411 to 370 to 331.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, I'm quoting the star here, and the question that was posed in this ranking includes, if money wasn't a problem, where would you study medicine? Would you send your kids to Ireland, Cardiff, Dublin, or University of Malaya? And the reason here is that many of them don't see University of Malaya to be in the same league as all these other universities that I mentioned. Why is that the case?
Malaysians always been very skeptical with our education system. Probably we're not doing as well before, but we are improving as time go on. If you look at these 3 or 4 universities, you put the Royal Surgeon, Royal College of the Surgeon Island, Cardiff University, and Trinity College Dublin, and none of these universities scored above 82 points as academic reputation in medicine and life sciences. UM does.
Yeah, okay. So UM outranks Royal College of Surgeon Ireland, they outrank Cardiff, they outrank Dublin. Why is the perception there? I mean, you were mentioning that the Malaysians are skeptical about our own quality of education of world-class status. Why is the skepticism still there?
Probably we're not doing as well before. We were not doing as well before. That's why I'm here to tell that we are improving. I'm here to tell that we are soaring upwards. That's what we're saying. We're telling the public that we are improving as we move along.
So let's take this a bit personal, not the public. Yeah. There's a text from a listener called Ravinder. Dato' Sri, where do you and other ministers send your kids? Do you send your kids to public schools or private schools?
Yeah, my kids, my eldest daughter went to public school, and she had her first degree from UIA. So my second son went to UITM. My third son also went to UIA. So they're from public schools. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. This is something exceptional in terms of ministers sending their own children to public schools. But many of your colleagues, they send their kids to private schools, both at education school-going level as well as tertiary level. Why is it that your colleagues are doing such? Don't you think that as ministers of the cabinet, they should be emblematic to the public of Malaysia and send their kids to public schools?
Again, it's an issue of perception. Again, I was saying we're here to correct the perception, saying that we are not as good.
But isn't it difficult to set the perception when the ministers themselves, not you yourself, but ministers in the cabinet themselves, don't see your work as commendable because they are still sending their kids to private schools?
Many other ministers are sending the kids to the public universities and public schools. There may be some who do send to the private universities, but you cannot say that all ministers are sending the kids to their private schools and public private universities. I mean, I would say otherwise, you know?
Yeah. Dato' Sri, let's move on to the story of the quality of graduates right now. We believe that the employability of graduates is under question. Do you think that Malaysian graduates can find jobs after they leave school?
Of course, if you look at the graduate employability percentage, which is now 76.1% this year, which is 1% better than last year, which is not good enough. I do understand that once we send our kids to universities to make sure that they get employed, there are efforts being done in the universities at the moment. That's why we looked at a few areas. We do have the CEO faculty program. We do have 2U2I program, 2 years in universities, 2 years in the industries. We look at ICGPA program. We're the first in the world to introduce that to make sure that students are more holistic. When I say CEO faculty program, we do invite CEOs from Asia, Azman from Kazana, CIMB, Shell, Motorola, to come to universities and lecture, and not only lecture, but also to look at the curriculum that we have to make sure that they are relevant. When we introduce 2U2I, we're the first in Malaysia, in the world, to do that, whereby you spend 2 years in universities and 2 years in the industry. 2U2I, nothing to do with 2U, nothing to do with you, and nothing to do with I. Okay? So that they know what's happening. Especially you, PM, are doing in the plantation where you spent 2 years in universities, in 2 years in the plantation, University Kelantan doing entrepreneurship. This makes sure that there's no issue of not being employed. And another one, very important also, we are the pioneering in the world is the integrated CGPA. When we don't just look at your CGPA, we look at your communication skill, we look at your entrepreneurship skill, we look at practical skills, we look at other skills rather than just academic to make sure that you are holistic.
Dato', there's two texts question coming in. One of them is Arya Ratnam, and also another one from an unknown text sender. They are asking, do you think that there is a competitive advantage for employability if a child goes to a private school instead of a public school? This is because private schools are perceived to have better holistic education, better English education. Do you think there is a competitive advantage?
If you look at the English, maybe, but not all private schools are good. We have some very good public schools. I mean, I'm not going to talk about schools today because I'm Minister of Higher Education.
Of course.
But of course, if you look at the ranking, we forget, you know. We were saying just now about medicine. Mm-hmm. But if you look at, if you want to send your kids to do engineering, and if you're given a choice, University of Malaya, as we said, Yale, Edinburgh, King's College, Cardiff, and McMaster. If you look at the ranking, University of Malaya Engineering stand at 54. All the others, even Yale, stand at 65, 73. But again, it's a perception. I would request all Malaysians to look at the figures, look at our ranking, look at our reputation, because we do have, in some areas where we are the top 100 in the world, we are doing much better than some of those so-called reputable universities throughout the world.
I'm speaking to Dato' Sri Idris Yusof, the Minister of Higher Education. Dato', there's a tweet by an individual called Hasif Murad. He is asking, do we still need universities for Bumiputras only? If I recall, one of your child actually goes to UITM, and UITM can be classified as a Bumiputra only university. Is there still a space for that?
The Malaysia still have this Act 153, which protects Bumiputra at the moment. So UITM serve that constitution needs of the of the of the country at the moment.
Then the question is, should we still have it? I mean, the constitution is there, of course.
Yeah.
The question is, should we have it?
It's an academic. I think that we still need to have this Bumi Putra affirmative at the moment. Depends how you look at it. Depends how it's being carried on. But still, it's still there. The constitution is still there, and the UiTM serve the constitution that we have at the moment.
Dato, let's move to another story here. There's a text from a listener asking you, how is the ministry dealing with local and foreign students, particularly in extremist activities and ideologies? Now, this text echoes the big question of the rising Islamic extremism. Datuk Sri Zahid Hamidi, the Deputy Prime Minister, also the Home Minister, have also addressed this publicly, but we would like to hear it from you on how to tackle this in universities.
Of course, this is a serious issue. The moment I come back from Raya, right on Sunday, on Monday itself, at 3 p.m., we call a meeting. We have a meeting with the police force. We had a meeting with the immigration, with KDN, you know. We have to look into it, and we do believe that we have to be more stringent in taking in foreign students to Malaysia. It's more stringent measures to make sure that those activities, those foreign activities, are not going to absorb into, not going to be our...
What are the concrete measures to deal with this? Because even a small issue of teaching the required course called TITAS or Tamadun Islam, Tamadun Asia, there's a controversy here where a lecturer in UTM actually took things in his own hands and basically inflamed the entire population of Malaysia in the way he taught this subject at that school, at that university. Do you think that TITAS, number one, should still be around? Number two, do you think that this, rogue lecturers teaching stuff that is not part of the curriculum is going to endanger the livelihood of Malaysians in general?
Okay, TITAS is required. But what happened in UTM is that he went out of the way and he's not using the curriculum provided by the ministry. It's got to be fully understood. But we are serious about it, and I'm telling BFM, I've not said this to anybody as yet. I've not said to the press as yet that lecturer has been fired.
Okay.
We're serious about it, and we have to take stringent action against him.
Now, you said that you would leave it to the management of the university to do it. So was it the decision of the university to fire him, or was it directed by you?
No. I mean, the university, they are autonomous at the moment. They hire the lecturer. They have the right to fire him.
Okay.
And I was being told yesterday that he has been fired.
Now, this individual is emblematic of the system itself. Does the government have a system in place where lecturers don't become rogue and start teaching extremist ideologies?
We were telling that lecturers have to be in line with the government policy. And again, this is not, we're talking about issue of Daesh, issue of IS. They're not even Islamic. So this is what we have to be doing. We have to be telling the students, we have to be telling the lecturers that they should understand what Islam is all about. They have to understand what jihad is all about. They have to understand what bay'ah is all about.
Datuk Sri, with all due respect, by you telling them that these are not Daesh and IS, are not the true Islam, we still see a lot of Malaysians, particularly Malay, undergraduates signing up for ISIS, they're flying themselves into Syria to be freedom fighters. Do you think that your work is not working?
We are starting. We are looking at it seriously because it's the issue of Daesh. It's a serious issue. It's real. So we're making sure that we're meeting the vice chancellor. We are making sure that we have to tell students, and also not only students but lecturers, we have to look at it. We have to tackle it seriously.
You know, the Nordin Maktab, Professor Azahari, these are bomb makers. They are lecturers. Do you think that... Are you worried that university lecturers are going to become...
I'm worried. You're right. I look at it as a real issue. Look at it, as I said, as a serious issue. That's why we are meeting the vice chancellors. We'll make sure that we have to tell the students, we have to tell the lecturers what is meant by the right Islam. You know, Islam has got to be taught in the right way, has got to be understood properly.
I'm speaking to Dato' Sri Idris Yusof, Minister of Education. Up next, we will be talking about the rebates in PTPTN, hopefully that will improve the lives of many graduates in Malaysia. This is BFM 89.9. On the breakfast grill this morning is Dato' Sri Idris Yusof, the Minister of Higher Education. Dato', let's jump straight into it. You have mentioned very recently that Malaysia has now over 56,000 students in higher learning institutes with foreign students. This puts us in the league of, say, United States in terms of foreign students, as well as above Vietnam. Do you think that Malaysia is truly becoming an international hub for foreign students to come here?
Of course, if you look at it, and we were, even 2 weeks ago, we were having a dinner with the British High Commissioner, and according to a survey by the British Council, that Malaysia top, together with Germany, as far as our open policy towards internationalization of students compared to UK, compared to Australia, and compared to USA.
Do you think we're attracting the right students from the right countries, particularly when these 56,000 students that come in, almost a fraction of it only is from the first world countries like US, UK, even Singapore?
Well, it's going to take time. As I said, we have to do more. We have to do more summer programs. Most of them do come for the summer programs. We have to do more short-term programs. We have to bring in some of the flying professors from them. We have to increase our perception to the Americans. And we have to do more engagement. I think we'll bring more of the students from the first world countries to Malaysia.
Because we have about 60,000 foreign students in Malaysia, how many of them are truly students?
We have 122,000 at the moment, actually.
120,000. So how many of them are actually truly students? How many of them are abusing student visas here in Malaysia?
They're truly students. There some do have problems. We do have problems with some of the foreign students before. That's why we introduced EMGS, this Education Malaysia Global Services, 2 years ago to ensure that those who come here are really students. So with the introduction of EMGS, we can control the so-called students who are not students.
The first half of this year saw VICE being cracked down by the Ministry of Home Affairs. And they say that a substantial amount of those being caught or arrested, they have student visas, particularly those in the sexual workers. They have student visas. How do you think this ties in with your statement that many of them are actually students?
There were, if you look at some do go to colleges and universities. We don't have much problem with those who go to colleges and universities because we have to scrutinize the educational background. We have to scrutinize capacity, the financial capabilities as they come in. But we do have issues, those who come here for short term, 2 to 3 months under language centers. So we are making sure that, again, we are looking into it, make sure that they really are students.
Still on foreign students, there's some protests in suburbs in Kuala Lumpur, in Puchong and elsewhere, where they protested against foreigners in this country who they claim to be foreign students. Do you think that Malaysia is becoming increasingly intolerant of foreigners, particularly when they live amongst us in the suburbs?
No, I don't think so. As you said, what they thought to be foreign students, but this is something that we have to look at probably. Because all the time when you see some foreigners, we have the impression they are students. They may not be students. That's why once we have the EMGS, they will be carrying a student card. The student card will identify whether they are really students or not. We're doing a crackdown on some of the colleges to make sure that's not going to happen. So hopefully by having EMGS, where we can track where the students are, where they have to produce the cards, we make sure that what's being said is not going to happen.
How are you going to track the efficiency of this EMGS program? Do you think that there is some quantitative measurable output where we can actually deduce that this is indeed working or not?
Sure. A student who carry a student card, you can, using a system, a tracking system, you know where they are, exactly where they are. For workers who come to Malaysia, you don't know where they are. For anybody who come to Malaysia, who claim who get a student card, we can track where you are, which university you are in, which college you are in. We can even track which country you come from, and we can track how many from that particular country, how many are there in this country. So it's a quite complete system to track the students.
Taking our focus a little bit away from the nitty-gritty stuff on foreign students, can I ask you, these foreign students in Malaysia, how do they feed back into the Malaysian economy, into the Malaysian system? Are we going to be able to make use of their talent, or do they just go back home and requisite their talents in their home countries?
Majority will be going back, but some do stay here. Some become part of our lecturers and contribute to our publication and citation, some good ones who want to stay here. Some are absorbed in the workforce in the international companies.
Do you have a measurement on those that stay back and feed back into the economy?
The numbers are not that many, but there's some. We don't have the exact numbers at the moment, but some do stay back. But the majority, as I said, would be going back to their own countries.
I'm speaking to Datuk Sri Idris Jusor, the Minister of Higher Education. Datuk, part of your portfolio also covers funding and also PTPTN, which is the government scholarship and loan sourcing program. Do you think that PTPTN is currently solving its problem of students not paying back?
Yeah, with the introduction of new method, we call CCREES, more and more students are paying back. Because it's been the attitude of students saying that it's government money. So if it's government money, you don't have to pay back.
Now, this is an assumption that you are making here. Could it be perhaps that students just don't have money to pay back? Even 100 bucks when you're earning, 2,000 ringgit in KL, that's already, 5-10% of your total income. Is it because of them having a nonchalant view that they don't want to pay back because of government money, or because they just simply can't?
No, you have to understand that PTPTN is very flexible. When you say they are not paying back, those people who never come back to you for the past 3, 4, and 5 years. I mean, what I'm appealing to the students, if you cannot pay back, do come to PTPTN and tell them that you can afford to pay. If you can afford to pay 100 ringgit or 200 ringgit, just pay 50 ringgit to the PTPTN, saying that you're serious about paying back. And I told PTPTN, never, ever make it tough on Malaysians, okay? But the problem we're having now is that they don't even appear. We do have those who are earning 10,000, those who are earning 15,000 are not paying. We locate that. We don't want to disclose who they are. But these are the issues that we are facing in PTPTN. Now, I would say that things are improving. That was the past. And now we see that normally in the past, last 1 year, last 2 years, PTPTN was collecting only 50 million to 60 million a month. Now they are collecting 200 over million a month. So PTPTN is doing good now. Malaysians are paying, thanks to Malaysian. It was before. But with the improved way how PTPTN is conducting themselves, more Malaysians are paying. But again, I want to repeat myself. If you cannot pay, do come PTPTN and tell them that you can afford to pay. If PTPTN not responding, do come to me. I want to make sure that PTPTN is not going to, in Malay, menganiayai anybody.
And there you have it, a personal plea by the minister himself. Datuk, let's move on to another subject. There's a tweet coming in from Ahmad Sohaimi asking, what are your plans for the future? And perhaps we can segue into this topic on the massive open online courses or MOOCs where individuals can just go online and study there. Is this a big thrust in the Ministry of Higher Education?
You have to understand that education has changed. Over the past many years, education is becoming more flexible. Education is no more rigid. You can get your education anywhere. With the online information that you can get, you can learn anywhere, anytime, anyone you want. So education is becoming more flexible. That's why the MOOC is very important. You can learn online. That's why you can get even a degree by learning online nowadays.
Yeah. So and because of this, are you worried about the quality of these online degrees? Do you think that could be counterfeits? There could be lesser quality in terms of, say, face-to-face learning versus online learning?
Of course, online has got to be accredited by MQA. There's no such thing as no accreditation. But online also need to be supported with face-to-face. That's why we call it blended learning rather than just totally online learning. Even the online learning that we have nowadays, it's blended, not totally online.
One of the best globally recognized MOOCs program is called Khan Academy. It's a non-profit organization created by Sai Khan with the aim of providing a free class, world-class education for anyone. Is this where the direction of MOOCs is going to be? Something like Khan Academy?
MOOCs is going to be cheaper to run because you don't need as many classrooms. You don't need lecturers' presence all the time. They will reduce the cost of education in the country. But as I said, education is becoming flexible. It's going to be a combination of MOOCs and normal classroom learning. That's why we are serious about it, because that's why Malaysia is becoming the only country in the world that put things together as a country. Others do, universities do on their own, but in Malaysia, we put all universities together. We have a consortium of universities that we do MOOCs together. And recently, our lecturer, Professor Amin Embi, won the Educators Award from Open Education Consortium, which is one of the biggest open university network, with recognition to what we have done so far.
Dato, in the UK, they partner the Department of Higher Education with the Department of Science and Innovation Technology. In Sweden, they have this triple helix model where they have corporates, companies like Volvo, IKEA, Scania, working hand-in-hand together with universities to jointly collaborate research papers and build practical users for research. Do you think that Malaysia has practical uses for our research papers?
That's why we're talking about not only triple helix, we're talking about quadruple helix. We're talking about collaboration with industries, whereby there's a reason we do have this CO faculty program. When they come to universities, not only to lecture, but also to look at their curriculum. Well, that's why I said we have CO2U2I program, whereby they work in the industries. So there's a greater collaboration with industries, not only in research, but also in designing the curriculum, how universities are being conducted. Some even have made university as their foster university. Asia. Asia has adopted UPM as a university that worked together closely with UPM. CIMB is working with UUM. And many other universities are working. Samsung is working together with UTM in Malacca. So there is greater collaboration now with industries.
The problem I have with research papers in Malaysia is that I fear that the blood and sweat and tears that is being poured into making these research papers are going to be lost into the ether. We're not going to be able to use them because of the non-practicality of it. Do you think that this is a real concern that I have, or do you think that most research papers in Malaysia do have a practical use for it?
You have to understand, once you do research, you understand the difference between fundamental research and commercialization of research. Before you can even commercialize the research are mainly fundamental research. It took at least around 10 years for you to really get the research to be commercialized. That is it happens throughout the world. And the success of fundamental research to get into commercialization is only around 4-5%, which is world standard. But again, we have PPRN in Malaysia, whereby small companies can go to universities and say you have problem with the product, you have problem with your quay, or bus company have problem to where to locate your bus. Small business have problem with that. We can go to universities, and we do have small researchers that become into realization within a year or 6 months, that would help the small businesses. That is a real commercialization on that small stage.
Dato, you were here 2 years ago, and there has been 2 cabinet reshuffles since. Do you think you've done a good job?
I don't want to... I'm humble with the cooperation that I get from the staff with the universities, not only private, not only public, but also private universities. But what I can say is that we are soaring upwards. We are improving as we go along from the last 2 years that I was here.
Final question, why soaring upwards? Why these very interesting terms?
If you look at, again, it's always been the perception. When I became a minister, in the ministry 3 years ago, people are saying we're nowhere. The perception towards education is bad, was bad. Now, 3 years down the line, I see that we are improving. Our ranking has improved. Our research has improved. And our citation has improved. In the global stage, we are getting recognition throughout the world. And as I said, alhamdulillah, we are improving. That's why the word soaring upwards keep coming in.
I have been speaking to Datuk Sri Idris Jusoh, the Minister of Higher Education. Datuk, thanks for being on the grill and thanks for keeping your word, for coming back. Okay. And also, Selamat Hari Raya, Datuk.
Okay. You want to see me back next year?
Inshallah.
Okay.
I'm Ibrahim Sani for BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.